As you heard, my name's Jesse. Thanks for having me today. I'm excited to talk to you about some projects that I've been working on related to the Dark Energy Survey, with the goal of testing Lambda CDM, our standard concordance cosmological model. And so I'm going to talk mainly about two projects that I've been involved in. One is something that we've been calling a growth geometry split analysis, which I'll say more about in a bit. But basically, it's a parameterization that we're going to use as a consistency test of Lambda CDM. And then I've also been involved in, and actually it was my introduction to the Dark Energy Survey, is the effort to develop and test a way to blind a cosmology analysis that uses multiple observable probes. And so I've just listed on the slide a couple things that I won't talk about, but that I've also worked on in case anyone's interested in chatting about them later. So when I'm not working on DES, large-scale structure analysis, I've done a little bit of work looking at large angle features on the CMB. So both looking at how systematics affecting galaxy surveys affects our ability to use large-scale structure information to try and reconstruct a map of the ISW signal, and also just a little bit more another project that was inspired by that, digging into the properties of some of these large-angle CMB anomalies that people have pointed out. So I won't say anything more about those, but as I said, I'm happy to chat about either of those things later in the day. All right. So to get everyone on the same page, if I'm going to talk about testing Lambda CDM, I want to talk about exactly what I mean by that. So just briefly, Lambda CDM is our standard cosmological model that has been built up over several decades of observations from many different observational probes. And it gives us this picture, this description of the universe, which is shown in this fairly familiar pie chart, which I show is also an excuse to share cartoons that I made for an outreach talk once. So this picture of the universe describes the matter and energy density in the universe as being made up, only 5% of that being made up by baryonic matter, stuff that we really know how to describe on a fundamental level.
Tiny point.
Yeah.
So most of that 5% is an atom, this plasma. So
okay.
Yeah, so.
I'll fix that.
Thanks. Wait, the plasma is made out of atoms?
But atoms, they're like ionized, they're not atoms, right?
So. Okay.
Fair enough, yeah.
All right. I'm only 5%.
Pardon?
Yeah. I'm only 5%.
Yep.
Yes.
Correct.
But you're not plasma.
Right. And then, moving around the pie chart, about 25% of the universe is made up of dark matter, a substance that interacts gravitationally, but not with light or very weakly through other forces. And we observe it we detect it based on how it affects visible matter gravitationally. The focus of my talk is going to be on this biggest area of the pie chart labeled dark energy, which makes up about 70% of the matter and energy in the universe, which is the name we give basically to whatever is causing the accelerated expansion of the universe on large scales. And sort of in the simplest model for what dark energy could be is what the lambda in Lambda CDM refers to, that being a cosmological constant. So a constant energy density associated with empty space. Given this model, given Lambda CDM, that description also the standard model of Lambda CDM also includes a description of gravity using the theory of general relativity. And since general relativity describes a relationship between space, the behavior of space-time and its contents, with our little pie chart and general relativity, we can predict the expansion history of the universe. So the background, the behavior of the universe on average. And so then we get this schematic picture of the history of the universe with time roughly shown on the horizontal, schematically shown on the horizontal axis with the vertical axis representing spatial dimensions. And you have the universe expanding and cooling over time. So we generally include in this paradigm a period of very rapid expansion at early times called inflation. As the universe cools down, eventually it'll cool enough to be able to form stable atoms, and the photons of the cosmic microwave background are released. And eventually, as you go along to the right, once dark energy starts dominating the matter and energy density starts dominating that pie chart, you start getting accelerated expansion. That same model, in addition to describing the background expansion history of the universe, we can also use to describe the evolution of structure growth. So generally, in models of inflation, you get a fairly generic prediction. You get a prediction for the statistical properties of fluctuations for the inflaton field, which then imprint as fluctuations in density. And as you evolve to the right, gravity does its work. We see the evolution of those perturbations as temperature fluctuations in the CMB. Eventually, they grow to form more and more clumpy density fluctuations, and you have, which then manifests as number density fluctuations in galaxies and large-scale structure in the late universe. So the fact that this fairly simple model of Lambda CDM with just a handful of parameters can describe the expansion history of the universe and the evolution of structure is a mark of success of the model. And observations of many different probes over the last several decades have all been consistent with the predictions of Lambda CDM. But our jobs are not over because there are plenty of open questions, which include asking what physics governed inflation, what are dark matter and dark energy, what are a more fundamental description of those things. And in sort of the interest of kicking all the corners and seeing where this standard paradigm is robust, we can ask, is general relativity a complete description of gravity in all environments, on all length scales? So to move forward on this, at least on the observational front, what we can do is go and make more and more precise measurements of the predictions of Lambda CDM and look for breaking points, look for places where maybe the predictions of Lambda CDM don't quite match observations, and that might give us some clues of where to go to try and answer these questions. So large-scale structure surveys are one of the handles that we have on being able to test the predictions of Lambda CDM, both in terms of a probe of expansion history and the properties of structure growth. And sort of now is a very exciting time for large-scale structure surveys, and that we're now and in the near future, we're going to have larger and larger data sets, which are going to give us more and more powerful constraints on the properties of structure growth in Lambda CDM. So the survey, the large-scale structure survey that I'm involved in is the Dark Energy Survey. I'm going to sort of talk about how large-scale structure and particularly weak lensing surveys can constrain Lambda CDM in the context of DES. So DES is a photometric galaxy survey using the 4-meter Blanco telescope at the CTIO Observatory in Chile. And over the course of 5 years, which we're currently on the fifth year of, the collaboration is mapping galaxy shapes and positions over about an eighth of the sky out to redshift of 1, which the look-back time there is about half the age of the universe. So it's a fairly deep survey covering a big part of the sky. I'm going to focus mostly on the galaxy position and shape measurements, but there are also components of the Dark Energy Survey that are studying galaxy cluster science and also supernova. So as I mentioned, the status DES is that we're currently taking the fifth year of observations. This plot shows a projection of the DES survey area on the sky. It's kind of got this funny shape in order to overlap with some other surveys. So the sort of bottom rectangle area overlaps with the South Pole Telescope's survey. And the sort of stripe on the top overlaps with is Stripe 82. It overlaps with SDSS and some other surveys. It's sort of a well-studied area of the sky. Back in August last summer, DES released sort of its first round of papers using data from the first year of, the first round of cosmology analysis based on the first year of data, which is sort of shown roughly in this crosshatched area. And sort of things are ramping up to start analyzing the first 3 years of data, which will use the full area. And the fourth and fifth years following that up will continue to use the full survey area and just go to a greater depth. And so the total survey area, once we get to the full area, will be 5,000 square degrees, which is about an eighth of the sky. So with these catalogs of galaxy shapes and positions that we can measure from the survey, what we do is we measure two-point correlation functions. So that's basically the excess probability of finding galaxies separated by a certain angle on the sky. And we are able to measure those two-point correlation functions from the data. We can compare them to the predictions from our model being Lambda CDM. By comparing our predictions from our model to the measured correlation functions, we can work to find sort of a best fit set of cosmological parameters. So specifically, for example, Lambda CDM or a given model of gravity and the expansion history will predict a very specific shape and also redshift evolution of these correlation functions. So you can see looking at this plot, so the different boxes are correlation functions measured in different redshift bins, with 5 being the farthest along the line of sight and 1 being the closest along the line of sight. And you can see that the correlation function goes up as you look in the plots to the left. The universe is clumpier at later times than early times. That's what's showing.
Something was terrible, right, originally. So is that ever sorted out? What was the problem?
Yeah, so we're working on revision. So the papers were posted on the archive back in August or July, last summer. The covariances are being updated for the second round. There was something to do with the estimate of survey area, which I'm not the expert to tell you exactly the details of the update, but there was something to do with pair countings near the edge of the survey that's been updated. Cosmology results don't really change, but the chi-squared got significantly better. That is being updated.
Okay, so the covariance matrix was just poorly estimated from the MOX or something?
I think I'm not familiar enough with the detail to say confidently exactly what was, but yeah, it was something, some approximation was made that has since been fixed, I guess. Yeah.
Okay. Edges are terrible.
Sorry.
Edges suck. Edges and surveys suck.
Right. The box should have that in there.
Yeah, well, I think it was something with, like, the number of pairs goes in there, and that was just being, I think that was incorrect, or that was poorly, didn't account for what happens when one of the pairs is off the edge of the survey or something. But I'm happy to chat about that later or look into it. Or...
But I guess the question is, should we worry about that? I mean, that this care misses most of the points, or is the reduced chi-squared bad, or not?
It was terrible.
Yeah, so in this plot...
But that correlates. It's hard to tell by eye, but...
Yeah, there's a lot of correlation between these points, so the error bars are not independent.
So that means that's why I'm asking for reduced chi-squared.
Yeah, it was 2, I think, originally.
2. Okay.
I don't remember the numbers offhand, but...
It's hard to think that the edges would make a factor of 2 difference in error, so...
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like the reference matrix is complicated, right?
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm.
The plots do look fairly similar, but that's a watch the space that's in the works, and hopefully should be the paper should be submitted back to the journal pretty soon, I think. I guess the one other thing I wanted to say on this slide is just to point out that when we do these fits, when we compare our theory predictions to our data points, we need to make sure that we're not being biased by, say, the assumptions that go into our modeling. So at least for the year one analysis, we've been fairly conservative and cut out a lot of the small angles to ensure that sort of uncertainties about the modeling of nonlinear structure, baryonic fix don't affect things. So these gray regions are the scale cuts, so we cut out a lot of smaller scales.
Do you know what physical distance that refers to the gray region?
I do not know offhand, sorry. So this is a plot from the sort of combined cosmology analysis released last summer. In the parameter plane that DES has the strongest complaints, so S8 is basically sigma 8 time multiplied by a factor of omega matter that makes these ellipses more circular and less banana shaped. And then omega matter being the fraction, the matter energy density component. And so the combined analysis that DES works with is the combination of the galaxy-galaxy two-point functions, the two-point functions from galaxy shape, so measuring correlations introduced by weak gravitational lensing, and also the cross-correlation between weak lensing shear and galaxy position. So these three different ingredients were analyzed all together to get these combined constraints. And so this all gives us a couple different ways of testing lambda CDM. So just doing the initial fit and asking, does our model fit the data, is already a test of lambda CDM. And so, for example, seeing that the chi-squared is a little high definitely is something to be looked into. And you can also compare the constraints you get from the dark energy survey to constraints from other observables, for example, showing in this plot, to the constraints from Planck, which are based on observables that are really at early time. So we're showing the fact that DES constraints and Planck constraints show up in the sort of the same region of parameter space is lambda CDM passing some tests, and that in a sense, it's able to predict the evolution from CMB time to the rather late universe that DES is probing. So the growth geometry split analysis that I am working on, which again, I'll say exactly what I mean by that in a minute, is an extended analysis that lets us go beyond using lambda CDM to further test the model. So if you want to test extensions to lambda CDM, there are a couple of different ways you can approach things. Sort of the simplest one is to, as I mentioned before, check agreements between different probes for what they say about the parameters in lambda CDM. You can also allow the dark energy equation of state parameter to vary and constrain it and see if our constraints are consistent with W being the dark energy equation of state being consistent with -1, which would correspond to a cosmological constant, or if it's not equal to 1, that signals a need for some sort of time evolution in the energy density of dark energy. You can additionally look at other parameterizations that, say, describe models of dynamic dark energy or models of modified gravity, which have slightly different predictions from lambda CDM for these two-point correlation functions and their time evolution. So when I say modified gravity, I'm talking about models that try to answer questions listed on this slide, which are, you can ask whether the accelerating expansion of the universe could be due to some deviation from general relativity on large scales, Or if you want to be a little bit more conservative, you can simply ask, on what scales and what environments does general relativity well tested? And that motivates a very active area of research of people looking at what are ways we can extend general relativity, or specifically extend the description of gravity beyond Einstein's equations, and which ways of doing that are allowed by current constraints, and do they predict any differences in terms of observables? So there are many ways that one could go about extending Einstein's equations. So just to demonstrate that, but without digging too much into the detail, I'm showing the slide by Tessa Baker, which shows basically some of the model space for different ways that you can add degrees of freedom to general relativity to extend a description of gravity beyond Einstein's equation. So I'm not going to spend too much time on this slide. It's mostly just to show there's a big model space that is allowed. The slide is a couple years old, so some of the parameter regions for these models are a bit constrained, for example, by the comparison of, say, the speed of gravitational waves and electromagnetic radiation from the binary neutron star observation last fall. But there's still a big model space that is allowed that by current data. And yep.
The recent neutron star merging experiments and its electromagnetic optical observation has ruled out a lot of these theories. Mm-hmm. Gravitational waves move at the speed of light to 1 × 10^15.
Yes.
And so, for example, Taylor's theories, biometric, they're all ruled out.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, as I said, the slides are a bit. Okay. Yeah. So yeah, I'm not sure if there's an updated version of this slide out there, but there is still like a large region of parameter and model space that is still allowed.
You cannot kill these models and just constrain the parameters. That's
the problem. Some of us think we can, but on theoretical grounds, right. Build the grounds, not on observation.
Right. Yeah. That's experimentally, I guess you cannot kill.
Yeah.
It's experiment. That's true.
No, they just constrain the parameters.
Yeah, but to such an extent that the modified gravity doesn't exist.
Yeah, well, I know, like, at least for some of these, and so Horn-Desky theories are a class of scalar tensor models. So you introduce a scalar field, and there's roughly, I haven't worked with these in detail, but I know roughly there's, like, 5 parameters or 5 free functions, I'm not sure exactly, that are allowed to vary, and of those, the constraint that speed of gravity equals speed of light basically constrains one of those, but there's still 4 degrees of freedom that are allowed to float around, so you can limit the space, but there's still a lot of room. So there are a lot of ways to sort of chip away at this and constrain parameterizations, both from different observations and also from theoretical motivations. If we're looking on sort of an observational large-scale structure way to try and think about how large-scale structure measurements can contribute to trying to chip away bits of that slide, I think it's helpful to think of the ways we can do these tests sort of on a spectrum from more sort of theoretically focused ways to more phenomenological ways of parameterizing deviations from lambda CDM. So sort of very simple ways of doing that could include measuring the dark energy equation of state, or say even giving it a little bit more freedom in terms of time evolution of dark energy, which is not explicitly a modified gravity property, but would potentially respond to basically just deviations in our observations from the predictions of lambda CDM. Sort of on the more theoretical end, you could pick sort of your favorite model of modified gravity, do all the calculations to go from, say, the Lagrangian that you might write down to describe how it deviates from GR, and get to the predictions for your, say, 2-point correlation functions. There's a lot of computational work that goes into making robust predictions for a given model to our observations. And this is a really big model space, and there's not necessarily models that are particularly well theoretically favored. So this would be really time consuming to go through and test, say, every single model that is maybe is not ruled out, say, from a theoretical ground or other observations. So that motivates sort of looking a little bit on the more general side. So there are sort of effective field theory-based models which sort of bundle different effects of specific modified gravity models together. And these would allow you to make some more general predictions for the behavior of deviations from GR. But these generally introduce enough degrees of freedom that they're very hard to constrain observationally. So I think the place that's going to be interesting to watch in terms of like observational constraints, at least in the near future, is going to be this regime of pretty phenomenological parameterizations, which look for effects that are fairly generically predicted by some models on this more theoretical end of this continuum, but introduce relatively few new free parameters, so there's actually a hope of being able to constrain them with current or new future data. So I would put this growth geometry split parameterization, which I will define on the next slide, in sort of this category along with these sigma mu models, which basically introduce, which parameterize deviations from the expected Poisson equation. So there's a couple different parameterizations that sort of live in this regime that are going to be really interesting from a observational phenomenological viewpoint in the near future. So the idea behind the growth geometry split parameterization that I'm working on constraining with DES data is to test the consistency of lambda CDM. So in lambda CDM, we have these predictions for the expansion history of the universe and for structure growth. And in this sort of simplest model, once you, the parameters that fix expansion history fix the predictions for structure growth. And it's sort of a generic feature of modified gravity models, which generally introduce some new degree of freedom, that you break that sort of one-to-one relationship between expansion history and structure growth. And so one simple thing you can ask is, do our measurements of structure growth agree with our measurements of expansion history? And our way of getting at that is to basically split parts of our cosmological parameter space. So at least starting out, we're just splitting omega matter. And because built into our analysis is the assumption of flatness, that also ends up splitting omega dark energy. And so for the cosmological parameter, where there was one, there are now two. We have a version that we call omega matter growth, one we call omega matter geometry. And basically, when you're computing theoretical predictions for different observables, when the thing you're calculating is related to expansion history or geometry, so say angular diameter distances or luminosity distance, we use the geometry parameters. When we're doing predictions related to structure growth, say nonlinear effects that change the shape of the power spectrum, we use growth parameters. And so the benefits of this parameterization, there are a couple. One being the thing I already said is it's motivated by something that's fairly generic in modified gravity models, in that you break the one-to-one relationship between structure growth and expansion history. And the benefit of it in terms of implementation is that it's pretty simple to implement because we're just doing a consistency test of lambda CDM. We can reuse a lot of the modeling from lambda CDM in terms of, say, nonlinear effects on the power spectrum. And I say that it's fairly model independent because there is a little bit of arbitrariness in terms of exactly where you decide to plug in geometry parameters and where you plug in the growth ones. But we generally are trying to make these in a fairly well-motivated way and just make sure we're consistent across the different ways we include things. The downside is, for the same reason that it's simple to implement, that we're not putting in a model that's really relates to some underlying description of how we think gravity works, That does allow us to reuse a lot of the Lambda CDM modeling, but it also means if we do detect a deviation, if we run our combined analysis and we find that the data are inconsistent with omega matter geometry equaling omega matter growth, it's not immediately clear what to do with that or exactly what that means. So that would be, it'd be more of a signal for deeper investigation than telling you something about underlying physics right away.
Why would you say this is better than the gamma parameterization, where you say the growth is omega matter somehow or gamma? So that's another, it's just that you're just training one parameter by another parameter, but it's, they do the same thing, don't they?
I think, yeah, they definitely do similar things. I think the benefit of this is compared to that. Lies in the fact that based on in the analysis pipeline, this is able to reuse a lot of the pieces of modeling that Lambda CDM uses.
So you need least amount of coding.
A bit, yeah. That is something that I intend to look into. I want to look, that hasn't been explored as much as I think it should be in terms of really understanding, yeah, is this just giving us the same information as that gamma growth parameter? Or like say, yeah, or there's also a sigma mu analysis going on for DES. And I think this is definitely complementary to that. And that's sort of looking at differences between lensing and dynamic potentials. But yeah.
That's definitely separate. But here it just seems that you're just parameterizing the growth either, and maybe gamma or omega matter growth, so it seems that
gamma is a purely linear parameter.
Linearity, but you mean this is not linear growth? This is good.
Well, you're using also, I mean, any skills that are not linear, it looks like, right?
Yeah, I mean, so so we're including modeling for that, though we are using all the same settings as the year one analysis, which cuts pretty conservatively to state a linear scale. So in principle, yes, this could let us use some of the nonlinear modeling from Lambda CDM. In practice, at least for the first year of DES analysis, it's going to be mostly linear physics that we're... Yes?
The measurements of tau. Are they close enough to minus one that you believe the Lambda model? I mean, it constrains these modified gravity theories to such an extent that I'm not interested anymore in the
Right.
Or if you were a little diplomatic, the question might be, you know, at what point if you can continue to see nothing, do you decide this isn't worth my time anymore and I should work on something else?
So I think we're at the point where these data sets are going to be growing and the precision of this kind of measurement is going to be increasing enough in the near future. I would say I don't expect to, well, say I've not run this on data for the DES year one, so I've mostly been running on simulations. It's likely to not be constraining enough for, with the first year of DES analysis to actually be able to say anything surprising. But in terms of getting ready and thinking of ways that we can use and leverage large-scale structured data, different ways we can look at what the data are telling us, sort of as a proof of concept for future analyses, I think. This is still an interesting and well-motivated thing to look at. In terms of deciding how tightly we need to constrain W to minus one before we all get sick of it, I think I don't have a good answer to that.
I think I should be the question. I should be where the theorists get bored.
Yep.
You should always be exploring the data.
Mm-hmm.
But the question, going back to the gamma versus the omegas, if you just go on the theoretical side, look at models, do they predict typically that the two omegas are related by one's the power of the other? Is it, what's the situation on the theoretical side?
So again, that is something that would be very interesting to dig into more in the future in terms of sort of understanding how some of these, say, Horndesky or EFT-based models, how those parameters project onto these more phenomenological parameter space. There's been a little bit of work there, but I don't think it's been explicitly looked at. So they're not necessarily like a one-to-one relation, like this parameter from Horndesky models gives you this effect on sort of the observable phenomenological end. I think there has been some work on that sort of on the sigma mu front, but it's not, at least is what I'm accessing right now in my memory. I don't think it's particularly well developed, but I think that would be definitely something that would be interesting to dig into more.
It sounds like you have less priors since you're letting them be arbitrary. So.
Yeah. So for this, it is, I'm sure that there are, regions of parameter space that are more or less theoretically well motivated, and I'm sure they project onto some space on the observational end. Our analysis right now is not taking that into account. We're working sort of, that's sort of why I'm framing this mostly as a consistency test. So like, rather than necessarily a test of any specific model. All right. So, in implementing this parameterization for the dark energy survey pipeline, I've been working with a couple of different people, including Eric Baxter and Vinicius Miranda, to sort of figure out how exactly to implement this split parameterization, because large-scale structure information contains information both about expansion history. In, for example, like projection effects of physical length scales onto your observed angular scales, as well as growth information. So this is where, as I said, a little bit of arbitrariness comes in. We have to make specific decisions of where how we introduce geometric and growth parameters. And sort of the main way that that's come in is how we handle the linear power spectrum, which was required some decision making because some parts of the power spectrum are going to give you geometric information, like the location of the turnover is really related to expansion history, the time of matter radiation equality. And so whereas the effects of the shape at late times from nonlinear physics seem fairly intuitively related to structure growth. And so what we decided to do is we sort of splice linear power spectra using the geometric parameters and growth parameters together so that you get sort of the overall shape set by the geometric parameters, whereas any evolution after some specific redshift, which we picked to be higher than any redshift our survey is accessing, to be dictated by the growth parameters. And we decide that all projection effects are geometric, and then any when we then feed this linear power spectrum in to include nonlinear effects on it, we use the growth parameters for that. And so this is showing what this modeling does to the power spectrum, with the black line being the fiducial lambda CDM modeling, the red line showing what happens when you change the geometric parameters. So you see a lot of effect there just from shifting this the linear power spectrum right and left. It's normalized to the scale there. So that's why it's a right or left shift necessarily rather than up and down. And then the blue lines show what happens when you change the growth parameters, which at least on linear scales is just an amplitude change, which is as expected for linear growth. And then start to having some scale dependence when you get to the nonlinear regime. So as I said, we've been testing this setup within the Dark Energy Survey Year 1 pipeline, running it on simulated data just initially to get a feel for whether DES data has the power to put constraints on these at all. So just noting that like the growth parameter has a relatively small effect on the power spectrum, it makes sense to ask, like, can we actually, is that an effect we can measure? So right now, this is showing some parameter constraints on simulated data. The red contour showing using the year one DES combined analysis data, so the same stuff that went into those cosmology papers back in August.
Can you go back? I guess I'm thinking, trying to understand what's going on. I guess you mentioned this. Shouldn't growth just shift things up and down?
I mean, what does make, I guess the geometry is the one that shifts left or right? And
that's correct, yeah.
So the growth just shifts it up or down or not? Or
yeah, so that's the blue lines is when just the growth parameters are changed. So at least on the linear scales, it's just up and down. And then
something happens. You do something.
That's from the nonlinear
modification.
Yeah, I use HaloFit.
But the way that these geometrical parameters enter your model is, I mean, is what exactly? I mean, like, so you use the geometrical parameters to make the linear power spectrum.
Yep. And then when we go from P of K, like the power spectrum, to the observed two-point functions, which comes in through lensing kernels as well as going from like K space to physical space, that's where all of that comes in.
So if you guys, you know, I mean, right, I guess this is fine. I mean, you guys also tried, you know, perhaps taking your observables and then finding, like, you know, combinations of them that'll be sensitive only to geometry,
mm-hmm.
you know, for example, right? I mean, so if you, for example, you know, do like, you know, galaxy-galaxy lensing at a fixed lens redshift or a source redshift, right?
Mm-hmm.
That should be sensitive only to geometry.
Okay.
Right?
We have not looked at that, no. It's an interesting idea. Right, so at least in terms of the simulated data, what I've been looking at is what DES alone can do, which we find that sort of as expected, because the growth parameter has a relatively small effect on that power spectrum, especially at the linear scales that we're cutting to. DES alone in these red contours is going to be pretty unconstraining for omega matter growth. And so we've started looking into including some limited external data. So the blue contours here show what happens when you include geometric information from supernova, from JLA, as well as a compressed likelihood from Planck, which has some, basically the location of the first peak and some parameters that are fairly specifically geometric. And initially we did this with just these four parameters that are in a compressed likelihood that the Planck team provides that's meant to be used for sort of dynamic dark energy constraints. And we found that in this growth geometry split parameterization, there's a lot of degeneracy, as might be expected, between the growth parameters and both sigma 8 and the scalar amplitude AS of the sort of initial power spectrum. In lambda CDM, those are related basically one to one. Since growth, the splitting introduces some new degree of freedom, we ended up needing to be able to actually say anything, to actually get a close contour in this growth geometry split plane, we need to include some information on AS from Planck. So it's sort of purely some parameters that are pretty specifically geometric and then sort of an early universe constraint on the amplitude of the power spectrum.
So do you have, did you have other like nuisance parameters, like, I don't know, the Halo model parameters, and the, I guess I'm trying to see what other nuisance parameters there could be. did you have anything
else? Yeah, so here we use all the same nuisance parameters as the main DES cosmology analysis, so that includes some, like, shifts in like photometric redshifts. It includes intrinsic alignment parameters. Yeah, exactly. So I've been trying to set this up as similarly as possible to the main analysis so that any difference we might see in the results is due to the splitting and not due to different analysis choices. The status is, so this plot is with neutrino mass fixed. Chains are currently running to do this to see what happens when we let neutrino mass vary, because that's the choice that we were making sort of in the fiducial lambda CDM DES analysis. So these constraints will almost certainly, will definitely weaken a bit. And then in addition to that, sort of my next step is going to be looking at how the split parameterization varies or covaries when we introduce systematics. So all of the choices that were made in the DES pipeline for choosing, say, where do we put the scale cuts, how do we model galaxy bias, for example, was made and checked for robustness with Lambda CDM in mind. So we need to redo some of those tests to make sure, or to at least understand that, say, would nonlinear galaxy bias potentially give us a false detection of this split not being consistent with Lambda CDM. So we want to really make sure we understand that well before we run that on actual data. So I'm happy to answer any more questions about that, but then I'll talk for whatever the remainder of the time is on my work on the blinding scheme for DES. So any questions?
Can I ask you one question in your, back in the covariance plots? It looks like omega growth is going, is covariant with sigma a, which is surprising, isn't it?
I don't think so, because if you look at the power spectrum, what's happening here is it's just basically an amplitude shift, at least at linear scales. And given the angle cuts that we're using, the thing that surprised me a little bit that I want to look into a bit more is the fact that the covariance, like the direction of degeneracy with the geometric parameters, is the other way, which just looking at the power spectrum, I guess I do have plots elsewhere of how this then projects into the actual data vectors we observe. And so even, I guess it's very large scales. But initially I was concerned that these two were going in different directions. But I think the fact that they are is sort of promising for our ability to like disentangle what these effects are doing. Is that? Any other questions on the growth?
Related to that, I mean, is the bias something that you, is one of those nuisance parameters that allows for the galaxy?
Yeah, so for each of the bins where we measure galaxy position, each bin has its a constant galaxy bias. So there's five parameters for galaxy bias.
So then I guess the overall amplitude is not something that you would see, because that would just be fitted as the bias. It should be the shape. That
yeah, there, and there's also some redshift dependence that, well, is invisible from this plot, but the changing the growth parameter will have some specific redshift dependence, though I think the fact that there is this degeneracy between sigma 8 and omega matter growth has to do with the fact that the redshift bins, the lens, the bins where we measure galaxy positions are like the lower redshift ones, because they're the one, so there's the galaxy samples that are the source galaxies for lensing, so the things that we measure shapes for, and then the ones where we measure position are the ones that are doing the lensing. And those are lower redshift. And so I think we're not able to get as good of a handle on how the growth will affect the sort of the redshift dependence of that from that growth parameter. So I don't think, so potentially with future data sets, if we're able to push deeper with sort of the galaxy position measurements, I think we'll be able to get some better constraints there. All right. There's about 10 minutes left, right? Is that? Yep. All right. So yeah, I'll just talk briefly about multiple blinding for cosmology analyses. So for this is just a very sort of high level sketch of the pipeline for DES. So there's a lot. There's a lot of work buried in each of the boxes on here, but roughly, to get cosmology constraints out of a survey like the dark energy survey, you have to go from pictures of the sky, so measurements of pixel values, to galaxy catalogs, so catalogs of galaxy position, shapes, fluxes, or whatever other properties that you'll measure. From those, you extract these summary statistics, these two-point correlation functions. And from those, that's what you put into your parameter estimation. And there's a lot of people involved. There's a lot of decisions to be made, say, about scale cuts, or is modeling linear bias good enough in order to make sure our cosmological parameter constraints don't get, say, biased by some of the assumptions that go into this pipeline. And you really want to make sure that when you're making all of those decisions, sort of your knowledge of where you're ending up in parameter space doesn't influence that. So that could be how close is W to minus one, or how close are the DES results to the Planck results, for example. And so the motivation for the idea of blinding is to, in some way, while you're making all these decisions to set up the pipeline to freeze the, or not freeze, to hide the output parameters so that until you've defined and checked that your analysis passed a certain number of predefined checks, only then do you either run on the unblinded data or look to see what your output parameter constraints are. And so when thinking about how to go about implementing this, there are a couple different things to consider and a couple different things a scheme for doing this blinding needs to do for it to be successful. One is that it needs to shift or hide the output cosmological parameters. That's the point of the blinding. But also you want to make sure whatever you're doing to hide the results from yourself aren't affecting your ability to check your analysis. So for example, for DES, one of the checks for deciding to do the combined constraints for, say, the galaxy two-point functions with the lensing two-point functions, there's a check for interprobe consistency. And so if we want to be able to blind an analysis that uses multiple probes, we would want to be able to preserve consistency between those different probes before unblinding. And sort of similarly, we want to preserve our ability to test for different systematic errors, checks on our modeling. So for the first year of DES analysis, there's sort of two steps to the blinding scheme. The first was the shear catalogs, the weak lensing catalogs, were blinded by multiplying galaxy shear by some unknown multiplicative factor. And so that was left in place before the until the shear catalog passed some number of tests. But because that affects the shear catalog and not the galaxy position catalog, that would mess with the consistency between the shear-shear correlation and, say, the shear galaxy position correlation. So that sort of step of blinding was in place for the shear analysis, but then had to be taken off in order to start working on the combined probe analysis. So in practice, for the combined probe analysis for DES year one, anytime, so there were a couple of rules of thumb. One was that you don't plot a prediction from theory on the same plot as data points of your two-point correlation or your summary statistics. And the other is that until things were unblinded, any plots of parameter constraints was either had no labels on the parameter axis or they're shifted. So this is just an example from, I think, one of the appendices or the methods paper, looking at a comparison between two different codes for parameter estimation. And so the thing we were concerned about are these contours similar and not necessarily where are they on the omega matter sigma 8 plane. So since we're ramping up.
So if you just set some rules, does that mean people will follow them?
Exactly. So yeah, so for the next round of analysis, we'd like to do something a little bit more robust than this in that, yeah, there's, on purpose or by mistake, it's very easy for somebody to forget to put in the line in their code to hide the axes, right? And so generally, the further to the right you can get on this little arrow, the more robust your blinding scheme is gonna get. Mostly, partially because generally fewer people are touching these parts of the data, it's different groups of people. And also it just becomes harder to, on purpose or accidentally, unblind the data that you're working with. So our plan for the year three analysis that I've been sort of testing the feasibility of is blinding on the level of the two-point correlation function, so the summary statistics. And we're doing this by anytime you measure a two-point function, so here is an example of a galaxy-galaxy correlation function, we multiply the two-point functions by a specific scale-dependent factor that effectively shifts the output cosmological parameters. And so what I've been testing is saying, in fact, does this shift the output cosmological parameters? And when we do, does the resulting blinded data vector still look like something from Lambda or WCDM, which is sort of a proxy for when we do our when we do our systematics test, are we still gonna make the right choices there?
So for Y1 was this done?
No, this is not for Y1.
So before unblinding Y1, was it clear that the fit was terrible?
So It was observed that the chi-squared, and I don't have the numbers at the tip of my fingers. There was a range of chi-squared that was decided would be acceptable to proceed before looking at what the chi-squared was, and it did pass it. So they put the number a bit high for reasons that I am struggling to recall at this moment. So I can look into that and let you give you a better answer to that earlier. But there, the chi-squared for the multi-probe fit did pass a threshold that was decided before they looked at it.
Oh, sure, right.
Yeah.
Right, for the combined.
But it was observed that the chi-squared was higher than.
Right, most of which came from just the galaxy 2-point, I thought.
Mm-hmm.
It just seems weird that this was done because it sort of like defeats the purpose of winding, doesn't it?
Yeah.
If you don't catch something that big, I mean, then what was the point of doing all this?
So I think there's still value in trying to make sure you define and think hard about like what kind of test you want the data to pass before running your pipeline. It's messy and it doesn't mean that you'll catch everything. And I think there's still, the goal is to not have to change anything in the pipeline after you unblind, but if you find something that very obviously does need to be changed, I don't think that means the blinding was like worthless to do, but it does mean that you have to be very honest with yourself and in the paper of what was changed after you looked at where the results are. Is that, yeah.
So I guess that this a bit confuses me, this discussion, because it seems that the fact that this question was large is the success of blinding, and nobody went and took the data so that you get good fit. You get very bad fit, and that's it. So.
Yeah. Well, some of the goal is to try and make sure you don't keep checking for errors until you get the numbers you expect.
But that's it. So nobody has done that, so that's why you get a terrible fit.
Right. So before unblinding, they should have noticed, hey, the fits are always terrible. There's, something is present in the data.
Yeah, there was some discussion about the fact that there are some assumptions made in the calculation of the covariance, and so there was, like, the threshold for what would be an unacceptable compared to an acceptable chi-squared before combining probes was sort of higher than what your standard expectation of, like, chi-squared per degree of freedom would be. And I think some of that had to do with uncertainties in the covariance matrix, and then later we did find what was one of the things contributing to that. And so that will be updated.
Right, so you could have found that out, previous to, publishing the Y1 papers.
Yes.
But after even unblinding, you could have found this out. And
yes, that's true.
But because of the blinding rules, you weren't allowed to fix the problem that was uncovered.
We are fixing the.
Sure, that's right, for Y3 papers, but not for Y1.
Oh, but no, for the revised, in the process of doing revisions of the paper for resubmitting to the journal, it's being updated. And there's like a section.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right, so I guess just very briefly, the way we're planning on blinding for year 3, or the way that I've been testing, which we'll be discussing at a collaboration meeting. In a week or two to decide if this is what we actually want to do to proceed, is we take our data vector, or basically the measurement of one of our summary statistics at a given angular bin and redshift bin, and the factor that we're multiplying by them is the ratio between the theoretical predictions for that same data vector element at two different cosmologies. So because we're able to do these parameter estimations, that means for any element of our data vector, given some input cosmology, we can predict what it will be in that model. So we do that at some reference cosmology, and then some cosmology that's shifted by some step in parameter space. And we take the ratio of those two things. And that is the factor that we multiply all the two-point functions by. And so what I've been doing is saying, all right, doing this in practice, does this actually work? Because if, say, we knew exactly what cosmology this was based at, this reference prediction would be similar to this. They'd cancel out. Great, you end up at the shifted cosmology. But the point of doing this is we don't know where this is, and we don't want to. until the end. So what I've been doing is some testing to see, given a simulated data vector, I can input a shift. So in these animations, there are different realizations of data vectors where the reference cosmology, so the thing that's in the denominator, is on this x. So the gray arrow is showing the input shift in parameter space. The black arrow is showing the basically the output shift, the difference between the input unblinded data vector and the maximum likelihood cosmology of the blinded data vector. And so I've done this looking at what happens even if the reference cosmology is very different from the observed cosmology. And I found that pretty in general, as long as you're within reasonable ranges, but even shifting pretty far, the input shift in parameter space from this in this blinding factor is pretty predictive of the output shift. So we do effectively shift cosmological parameters. And I've also looked at the sort of distribution in chi-squared between the blinded and unblinded data vectors, which are shown in sort of a histogram here, where the blue is for the unblinded data vectors, the green is for blinded. And the fact that these chi-squared, they're not, distributions are similar, they're not exactly the same, we're taking to mean that doing this blinding doesn't introduce anything that will drastically change the consistency, say, between different probes. So I'll wrap up there. So just to summarize, large-scale structure surveys like DES will give us an opportunity to test Lambda CDM in a couple different ways. And making sure we sort of understand what pieces of modeling, what pieces of data our observables are sensitive to. And so looking at a couple different ways of parameterizing deviations from Lambda CDM can give us a little bit more information, say through this growth geometry split parameterization. And also we want to make sure that when we're doing our Lambda CDM constraints, we're protecting against systematics as much as possible, including those that might come from us. And so both of these we're implementing sort of in the near future or plan to implement in the near future for DES, but will hopefully also sort of be a test bed for other future large-scale structure surveys. Thanks.
So I guess it's the idea that there's some special people who know what are these, I guess, blinding or shift parameters, and then they apply it to data, and then send it to the rest of the collaboration. Is that?
Yeah, so exactly how we're going to implement it is a little bit up in the air, but sort of the plan, at least the sort of rough software that I've written so far, is set up so that you select this delta theta from some distribution in like a pseudo-random way, so you give some like string key, and if you give the same string, it will give you the same random parameter, but you don't actually know what that is. So that's at least the plan as it is, and in general, a lot of people doing parameter estimation are working with, like, are given the two-point functions in a file, and then you run your parameter estimation on that. And so a lot fewer people are working with generating these two-point functions. So I think the idea would be, and still a little bit of work in progress figuring out exactly how this will work within the collaboration, but for a while, only the blinded, I think the idea is that only the blinded version of the summary statistic will be available until it is decided to distribute the other ones. And I imagine we'll make, even after the unblinding, I think it would make sense to have both the blinded and unblinded versions of these two-point functions available to people who want to work with them. So hopefully to encourage people doing their own analysis to sort of implement some blinding. And it does take a little bit of time to set up, so the easier you can make it for people to blind, I think the more likely they are to do it.
But that's after the data is public, like before.
Yeah, I think, yeah.
I'm just trying to understand, is it more of a psychological game that, I mean, the idea is that people don't, you don't want people to buy, to change their analysis to fit the Lambda CDM prediction, right?
Mm-hmm.
But then, of course, the problem is you could have like a black market of people setting the shift parameters.
Yeah.
And then.
Yeah. So I was in a discussion about sort of blinding sort of in a general sense, and somebody, so there are two jokes that are I've heard multiple times about this. One is you could just make a very complicated black box that does nothing. You can only do that once, though. And the other is you want your blinding scheme to be robust enough so that people who don't know what they're doing can't unblind on purpose, and people who do know what they're doing can't unblind on accident. And so I think that's kind of the goal. Because, yeah, I mean, even with the current status, like, it's very easy to, like, not hide your access label. So nothing's going to be perfect, but we can try and make it a little bit more difficult. Any other questions?
I'll ask a blinding question. So if I think of blinding as a list of things that I'm not allowed to look at, then should it be on the list? Am I allowed to look at the chi-squared of my power spectrum to the best fit lambda CDM parameters? Is that okay to look at before I'm blinding, or
yeah,
without knowing what the parameters
yeah,
are?
Yeah,
but we can look at the max, mm-hmm, the yard max, or
exactly, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so I guess, yeah, in at least if we've implemented it, we decided that was a thing that we would look at because that was one of our checks on, say, whether these different two-point functions were consistent with one another. I don't think there's like a one-size-fits-all answer. I think for any specific analysis, you have to need to decide what are the things we absolutely need to look at to make sure we, say, trust our analysis, and what are the things that are sort of the output parameters that are potentially most sensitive to conscious or subconscious wanting to like fiddle with things until they give you what you expect. I think it's possible also to sort of have multi-stage blinding. So like, I think for year three, even though we're doing this more robust thing on the level of the two-point functions, we're still going to blind the shear catalogs. And while the shear catalogs are blinded, then the chi-squared for best fit, at least for the combined probe, doesn't really have any meaning because we're doing something that makes the different probes inconsistent with one another. So I think it's all, I would say, specific to what you need to do to make sure your analysis passed certain checks. And
it would have cut this, you know, reduced chi-squared equal to two problems.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, you could say that the most important output of the experiment is whether lambda CDM fits the data or not.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't want to bias that. You don't want to bias your answer. But
yeah, I guess if you were to do that, you need, I mean, there are a number of other sort of like null test things that are done before unblinding. That is sort of one of the key ones. Yeah, I guess if you're testing, if what you're doing is trying to make really precise measurements of lambda CDM parameters and you want to check, is W equal to -1 or is this consistent with the Planck sort of parameter space, you're sort of working with the assumption that everything is lambda CDM. But then, yeah, there is a question is when you, say, have unblinded your main lambda CDM analysis and now want to start testing extensions, in a sense, you're already unblinded a little bit because you've seen what happens in lambda CDM. So, yeah, there's definitely some murky grounds, and it's not a panacea for potential problems that could crop up. But it's one thing that we can do that could help. So we might as well.
All right. I have more unblinded questions, but we'll save them for lunch.